Hi, this is Mark Garza of Embodiment and the Famine, and this is my chapter of As the Story Grows.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
I am being realistic.
As the story grows.
Mark Garza, how are you doing, brother?
I'm doing well, sir. I am doing well.
So you were out of town for the holidays. What were you up to?
We do a lot of traveling as a family, just trying to see our great state of Texas, you know, and not only that, we travel kind of all around the country, just having a good time, because there's a lot of places I tell my wife that I saw casually on the road, but never got to actually visit, you know, because we're so broke on the road. So kind of going back and kind of checking out, you know, all these places that we went through and never really had a chance to sit back and enjoy. Like, we got back from San Diego the other day, and then decided to drive down to Austin, and we've been to Boston recently and a bunch of other cool places like that. So I've been blessed to be able to afford to do some traveling, so it's been great.
That's cool. What are you doing for a living?
Actually, I run a pretty good company of my own that was born out of my necessity to find work, I guess, in and out of playing in bands. I worked construction, and I did that for a while until I got tired of the boss man making the money, so I started my own company about 10 or so years ago, and so now I build stores for Domino's Pizza. They're my largest client, and so I've been doing that for quite a few years now. So basically,
you build Domino's pizzas.
I build Domino's pizzas, yes sir.
Wow,
yeah, it's a pretty good gig, and you know, I've built my whole company around it, and it's afforded. Me and my family a lot of really awesome perks and freedoms and stuff that, you know, we're blessed for. So I'm really
good for you, man. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So. That's super interesting to me, actually, because I love hearing, what people do for a living to, you know, accommodate tour schedules and stuff. Cause I could never figure it out. I had to just go do the 9-to-5 thing. And then the weekend warrior, you can only travel so far before you have to do an about face and run home to be at work on Monday.
Absolutely.
So.
And that was the main problem.
Sucked.
And that's why it kind of made it kind of the obvious choice. That way you can kind of make your schedule and come back and forth. And Austin, the cool thing about it too, is Andy from Embodiment and the Famine and Jason from Embodiment, we all are in the construction business and run pretty good companies. So it's been pretty neat. So
good. Good for you. That's awesome. Glad to hear somebody's doing something great with themselves. That's cool. And you're your own boss, or
I am. It's a company that I started Let's see. Actually, back in 2001, and we've morphed several different directions. And I guess the economy's changed a lot in the past, 15, 16 years. And we've kind of just adjusted as we went. And it afforded me to run into a gentleman on one of our jobs that owns a hell of a lot of pizza shops. And he was eyeballing me at a job one day, a job that we were doing, and introduced himself as one of the largest franchisee owners of Domino's Pizza. And next thing you know, I've been building stores for him going on 4 years now.
That's so amazing.
It's been fantastic, guys. He's awesome. He's no holds barred, but he's a great, great guy, and he's helped build my company. So it's been fantastic.
How many franchises does he own?
Over 50 and growing. So
wow.
It's all I do. It's all we do. And I don't work for Domino's exclusively. It's just I don't have any time to do anything else with anybody else.
Right. Right. So, I get it. I'm just wondering because I do. I'm a vendor for. We have a Domino's account with my company.
Awesome.
And the guy owns 9, and he has like his own business center and everything. Yep. And he's rad. He's a great guy. He was like, right. I totally would have taken you to the pizza convention in Las Vegas. And I was like, you're going to take your exterminator to the pizza convention? He's like, I don't give a shit. I would have taken you. I was like, oh okay. And then, next year, I guess.
All of our clients just got back from Vegas too. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. They just got back from Vegas. That's very funny. All right, enough about pizza. You're making me hungry, dude.
Right.
So, Mark Garza, the drummer. Let's see. Let's draw a line as to where I connect with you. I bought the embodiment, Embrace the Eternal, like everybody did. And rad album. Everybody loved it. Blah, blah, blah.
Thank you.
I actually met you guys in 2008 at a Cornerstone.
How fantastic.
Talked to Andy and Nick more than anybody because I felt like every time I went to the merch table, Chris was never around, and I bumped into you like once or twice. But
right.
You and I have kind of talked here and there, not much, but mostly trying to get you on the podcast. Now I see you're so busy; it's kind of tough to nail you down. So I appreciate taking the time to do it. But let's wind it back. Where did this all start for you?
It all started for me. I say me, but it's really a group of guys, which has been Andy, Jason. Me and Kevin, just little kids, man, just not really knowing what was going on. We just wanted to have a good time, and so we just started playing. And it's hard to kind of wrap my head around, what the hell we thought we were trying to do versus what we actually did. Because right. Growing up in Arlington, we saw Pantera do their rise. They're our local boys, and so all basically we just thought, okay, let's do the same thing, and that's what we started to do, and we started to play, and we started to record, and then it just kind of grew from there. It wasn't about getting chicks, it wasn't about anything like that. It was about just playing music, and then you add the faith element into it, which was a big element. Early on, that was a really fantastic thing for us, and it made something special, and kind of grew from there. And I'm talking, we were playing clubs that we weren't even old enough to be in. We'd go in and we'd play real quick, and then they'd make us leave because we weren't old enough to be there. So we started off just super duper young and with no direction except to just play music, and that's what we did. So,
but some pretty.
And we did it all from school, hanging out in school. We would kind of all go to school together and then come home and jam. And like I said, we just didn't know any better. We didn't know how it was supposed to happen other than just writing some heavy songs and listening to some heavy, heavy-ass music. We just tried to replicate it, and that's how we did it. So
I kind of set you into a little bit of a separate category with some of the drummers of that era when Embodiment was coming up through Solid State. It was a little bit after you guys were, how old are you?
I am 40.
So am I. So you're right around the same age. You guys came in after the Vengeance, Deliverance, Believer.
Now,
you know, all, you guys came.
So now all that was man, it was after, but we I'm talking on the tail end of all that. We came in because right. We knew that was out there. Especially Believer and Vengeance and all that. And I actually have a letter from Robert Martinez when he left Vengeance Rising, and he put out that big angry letter. I have that letter.
Stop it. Talking. I got that letter too.
Do you too? Okay, yeah.
No, wait. I read it once. I read it one time, and I started calling some friends, and I was just like, holy shit. Yeah. You're not going to believe what I just read. My mom found it and threw it away.
Oh my gosh. No. You know, I had Jason, Andy, and Kevin over probably about 2 weeks ago just to reminisce and kind of look over a whole box of just a big box of shit we had. And I pulled out that letter. I go, look at this. And they looked at it and were laughing. And we're just laughing because he sent that because we ordered some stuff from him and he never ended up sending the stuff. Instead, he sent the letter and kept the money.
Me too.
Yeah, so great. So it was just funny to me. But anyways, we
yeah. But wait a minute. Wait. All joking aside, dude. You opened up a can of whoop ass. This is great. Screw embodiment. Who cares?
Right. Let's talk about the other stuff.
Right. That letter. Like at first, it was like, yes, I'm pissed off. I'm angry. Okay, this right. and that. Okay. But then, if you flip a couple sheets in, he had like. Photocopied receipts where he was like, I bought the equipment, it's in my name, Die Happy stole it.
Right.
And I was like, well, that's kind of hard to argue. I'm staring right. at the receipts. And like, even as a kid, I was like a 15, 16 year old impressionable kid. It didn't know my ass from a hole in the ground.
Right.
And I'm still reading these things like, I don't know, man. I think Martinez has like a legal case here, you know?
Right.
I don't know. But I'm just saying.
But the funny thing about it is that we wrote it off as him being just an angry, cynical, like, you know, guy that was just fell off his rocker. But you talk to tons of guys now, they sound a lot like Roger Martinez about just this anger, this overarching anger about, you know, the shit that they had to go through to do what they were trying to do.
Right.
And you and I briefly talked about that earlier. Not that, you know, I can't judge him because I have the letter, but it was too difficult for me to read because he it was on a fax piece of paper, you know. I mean, it was hard to read, but I still have it actually. And it, I understand it. I understood his point, but I also at the time we were just, you know, sky's the limit. This guy and, you know, a lot of the older guys, we didn't identify with them the way we identified with what we thought was kind of the second generation, which was the Living Sacrifices and.
Right.
All those guys. That's who we really identified with, and not necessarily
that's crazy.
The Die Happy and Believer. Although we did, I listened to Believer. We had their tapes actually, Clank and all that other weird stuff that was out there at the time.
I was gonna put you in a separate category, not on your own. I'm sure there were other drummers doing it, but you were the one. In my mind, is kind of a. I feel like maybe I'm off base saying this. Maybe I'm talking out of school. I feel like you kind of took a stand against how drums were at that time. Like back, my point was when you heard Chris Hyde play on a Deliverance record, mm-hmm. or you heard Ted play on a Tourniquet record, or right. you heard Joey play on a Believer album, except Dimensions, because right. that was an electric kit. But like a lot of drummers. As the second era started ushering in, there were drummers that were like just playing more of like a straight hardcore beat, so they were still recording acoustically, or right. metal was pushing itself so extreme that they started doing drum replacement and click tracks and snap grids and all that. And I feel like, I mean, I specifically remember a video on Architects of Guilt where you were like, nah, I'm not having it. I want to record it the old way. But I felt like you were doing it back in Embrace the Eternal too, because your snare, I could tell you weren't hitting the snare as hard when you were grinding during the slower parts.
There was no sound replacement and all that stuff during Embrace the Eternal. Matter of fact, that was before Pro Tools when we did that, because we went back and recorded our next record with Barry Pointer, and he had a whole new system, and we're like, what the hell? We liked what you had before. And you couldn't really tell.
But Barry was like, but this system makes your album sound like every other band I put out.
Right. This is the wave of the future.
The way of the future. The way of the future. The way of the future. The way of the future. The way of the future. The way of the future. The way of the future. The way of the future. The way of the future. The way of the future. The way of the future. The way of the future.
Stay here. I'll be right back.
And so, but seriously, in all seriousness, we actually, you couldn't tell a big difference on guitars or vocals or really anything else, but you could tell on the drums. It was painfully evident that technology was changing, that recording techniques were changing, and that basically drummers were allowed to. It's hard to really talk about it without feeling some disgust about it, because what it became is a complete and utter joke, and that's what you probably saw with the famine. It's why I didn't want anything to do with that. So when we did, the tempos are all over the place on that first Embrace the Eternal CD, and then we come, when you listen to Embrace the Eternal, the tempo is just all over the place. But that's what I loved about it, right? So
right, that's what I meant. There's four human beings pounding this out. It wasn't like
absolutely.
I mean, I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but I mean, hey, kids, if you think Black Dahlia is an amazing band, the shit's not real.
it's absolutely not. It's not at all. And so that was kind of the impetus of what had happened. Fast forward again 10 years now, and we started the famine. What we want to do is do the famine and do it right. So I completely, you know, was on this path of trying to make the most brutal sounding drums that we could do. Now we used Andreas Magnusson. He produced it. He did a fantastic job, but he spent way too much time on the drums. He spit shined everything, and and it's going to sound weird, but I had to play it the way he recorded it. So when you saw us live, it may have sounded completely over edited, but I pulled the shit off live because I had to. And
I saw footage.
It goes back to something else I was going to tell you about the dynamic between me and the guitar player. And I'll touch on that later as I rabbit trail about this. But then when we did the second album with the famine, Architects of Guilt, all that went out the window, and Solid State wanted to have some. I know people get pissed that I call him a dumbass, but Jason Suecof, I don't know how much money they paid that guy to master the record, mix it, and touch it, and everything. And I simply made the comment that I didn't want him to mess with the drums. And even the guy that recorded the album, I didn't want him to mess with the drums. If I double hit something, if something didn't sound completely right, let's leave it in. Let's see how it sounds. And I got so much pushback from everybody about it. Including, like I said, Jason Suecof and all of them were just like, you know, I could tell they were put off by it, because that's not what was being done at that time. What was being done is everything on a grid. You weren't even tracking bass drums at that time. You were punching them in and sampling and punching and punching and punching. And it had gotten so pathetic that I just was just like, this is not real. So anyway, so now fast forward. So we record Architects of Guilt. And which ended up being my last record with them. And I was so ultra proud of it. I was so happy about it. And I thought it was a throwback to like the early days of early Metallica, early Slayer. When you listen to that shit and you hear the mess ups, you don't hear everything perfect. Everything is not perfect. It's raw and it's real. And it's the way it sounded live. But again, I got pushback from the band. I got pushback from everybody about that. And we did. We videotaped an argument because there was this really asinine, time in the studio where Andy was asking me to do something that nobody could physically do. And he wanted.
I remember that. You were like, dude,
on the damn album,
I know my limits.
And I was like, dude, stop. This is ridiculous. Just stop. You know, because I've sat there and I've watched guys. I'm not going to say necessarily like Andy, but I've watched guys sit there and play these ridiculously stupid sweeps, and they fuck them up really bad, then they go back and they fix them all, and now this guy's an amazing guitar player, you know? And
right.
It's the same thing with drums. It's like I've seen these guys do this, like, the most absurd stuff on drums, and then only to go see them live, Lamb of God, and they can't pull the shit off. And it's just like, I mean, it's just pathetic to me. That's just me.
They can't pull it off, but they have six laptops going, so they sound fine.
Absolutely.
Out front.
But see, get this, you know, and we fell into the same trap. So I ran around with a Pro Tools rig that I control that did backing guitar tracks and junk and all kinds of, never any drum tracks on there. I wasn't going to be that guy, but you know, I saw what was becoming of metal and saw that it was just a joke. It was a complete, utter joke. Then I remember Solid State rolled out a band. I don't remember who they were.
Yes, you do. Come on.
I don't. And I honestly don't, because, and that goes into, if I don't remember your band, you were shit anyways. It doesn't matter. So
that's fair enough.
This band.
Roll up your sleeves, Garza. Come on.
But this is the thing. So they played and they sounded nothing like their album. And I was so offended, and I was just, that was a death knell to me. We played with this band. I don't know where we played with them. We went on a small tour with them, and I was so disgusted. I was just like, this is not, no.
Uh-uh. Gross.
So it was gross. It was actually gross.
Everybody is so quick to shit on, like, name a pop star. I don't know, Taylor Swift or something. If they're singing right. over a backing track or
right.
a pre-recorded track, they're so quick to jump on that and say it's fake. Hey, metal, you're letting the same thing happen to your genre.
Dude, oh my God, metal is the worst offender. You know, they laugh about auto-tune and all this other junk that happens with rap and country sounds like shit now. Pop music sounds horrible. And metal better not act like it's not. When it comes to editing and drums and guitar and technicality, they were one of the worst offenders. And it just made music have no soul. You listen to 99% of what's coming out, and it doesn't have a soul. It's not even worth listening to.
Right.
And it's sad because, I'm not. It's not that I'm not a metal fan anymore. Metal is just not metal to me. That's why I'll pull out a Suffocation record. If I want to listen to metal, I'll listen to the Bleeding Cannibal Corpse, or I'll listen to, or even a Living Sacrifice record. Or, you know, dare I say it, I'll pop in a Famine album or something that has a twinge of what I remember metal to sound like. I don't know, man. It's not sour grapes, because I recorded a lot of good music. I feel like in my heart, I really feel like I did the best I could. And it's not sour grapes. It's not the direction I would have wanted metal to go.
Right.
And I also know that had the Famine kept doing what they were doing, we would almost have been forced to go that route, because, like I said, it was nothing but butting heads with everybody in the process when it came to spit shining a record to make it sound like what everybody else is making it sound like. Because what the kids don't know is that when you don't do that and your record doesn't sound like everything else, nobody will hear it. It goes away.
Right.
And it's pathetic. So I don't know. It was something that was very, very important to us. And it goes back to what I was going to say before. The reason things sounded different, I feel like, with Embodiment, early Embodiment, and versus everything else that was coming out, including Living Sacrifice and all that, was we simply wanted to be heavier than everybody else out there. It did not matter what it was. We just wanted to be heavier than everything else out there. That was our goal, was to basically just, me and Andrew play off of each other, where he would do these, he would focus on his guitar work and he would get so good, and I would get pissed off and I would focus on my drum work and I would get better. That way I could be better than he was on guitar. And we did this back and forth and back and forth till it became stupid. And that's when we started recording, and it was excellent. It turned out pretty ridiculous and pretty fantastic, I think.
He is crazy good.
That's really what it is. We just pushed each other, you know, pretty hard, and
good,
and stayed as heavy as we could possibly stay until that daggum next record, which was a big time departure. So.
Yeah, you want to discuss that? I think the overwhelming question that I heard everybody say was, why would they just switch band names? Like, right. Like everything changed so much. Why would you even keep the name Embodiment? So let's go tackle that 800-pound gorilla. If Chris left the band, and I think the dude's name is Sean, right?
Right. Right.
Sean from Within came in, and from everyone
came in.
And everybody ran out and bought Narrow Scope of Things. And everyone was like,
what?
Okay. Yeah. So let's talk about that curveball that you threw the whole planet. What was that
okay,
all about?
Okay, so, well, yeah, that was one of the big subjects that we talked about at our little band get-together the other day. And I guess I officially took blame for all of that.
You did?
Kind of half-heartedly, but I actually did. Only because, okay. Only because I just felt like, you know, what would Embodiment sound like, being heavier than what we did before? Because we're a progressive band. We've always been progressive. We always try to change and do something different.
Okay.
And at the time, you know, we weren't trying to be a slave to the genre. We're just trying to play what we liked, and that's what we did. But there's a lot of behind the scenes about how that all happened and what we were trying to accomplish as far as recording a good record. First and foremost, we wanted it to be good and we wanted to be able to play it live and for everybody to like it. So we had our ideas of adding a lot more melody and adding a lot, not being so percussive, but being more melodic, which I know was a kind of a bad thing back in the day. But what we did is we integrated a lot of that in, and we thought that everybody was on board, and Chris was not on board. You know, and it was a hard time in the band to kind of figure out, you know, because Andy and I were very honest about what we wanted, and we thought everybody else was honest, and we thought Chris was on board. He just flat wasn't on board, so we got rid of him, and found Sean, who was just ready.
Oh. Really?
Yeah. So
I think I was under the impression that Chris left and Sean was a singer left.
No. You said you're under the impression that Chris left?
Right. I was under the impression that Chris left Embodiment and you guys brought in a new guy, and I think everybody else was under the impression of like this new guy kind of just changed how Embodiment right. sounds, and the whole thing went in a different direction. You guys made a conscious decision to head that way, and Chris said, uh-uh.
No, we made a very conscious decision. Actually, no, he didn't. He agreed, and he, I guess, getting down to nitty gritty, he said he would write stuff, and we would have practices, and he would, oh, I've got a cold today, I won't be at the practice. I'll see you guys next week. So we practice again. Oh, I'm sick today, I can't come out. And then we finally realized, you don't have shit, do you? And called him out on the carpet about it, and he didn't have shit. He's a shitty lyricist, unfortunately, and. Anything that you hear that was written on an Embodiment record or even The Famine was written by Andy Godwin. It wasn't written by Chris.
The lyrics are written by Andy.
Lyrics are written by Andy. And that led to the second departure of Chris getting kicked out of The Famine, was because you got to think about it. You know, Andy is a very, I guess he's got a lot of convictions and very... I'm not gonna say spiritual. I don't want to say that. He loves God. He loves Jesus, and he's very convicted about his belief system. It means a lot okay. to him. His faith system means a whole lot to him. And so he wrote what meant a lot to him, you know, lyrically. And then to have Chris turn around and you know, we were, what a lot of people, all the, a lot of the inside baseball junk about that was, is that Chris just didn't want to sing some of the songs because he thought it was bullshit. He thought, you know, well, I don't want to sing this song because I don't believe it. And we would have mindless arguments with the guy about this until finally I just was like, no, you got to go. So, and that's what we did. Pretty much both times with Chris. The first time was, and it was silly how history repeated itself, but, you know, in a perfect world, we loved Chris and we wanted him to be a part of it and we wanted him to contribute, but it was just like dragging him like a sack of potatoes to every goal that we wanted with the band until we just got tired of dragging him, so we let him go both times.
Was he, you said that he said, this is bullshit, I don't believe in it. Was that from the beginning, or was there like a spiritual change?
It's a funny thing. No, here's the funny thing about it, and this is the thing that we kind of talked about the other day too. It's a very conscious effort to be a rock star when you feel like it benefits you, and you got eyeballs on you, and you want to pretend that you're something that you're not, and then, you know, you want that credibility to show your face somewhere else, and. Not to beat around the bush, I just feel like, you know, come Cornerstone time or come time for a nice tour, it was really cool and really easy to, you know, sing those lines and play that part and have everybody pat you on the back and tell you how great you are. And then the other times when it just wasn't so popular to have that opinion, popular to be a Christian or popular to have faith, you know, it's guys like him that were like, yeah, I don't believe that anymore. And it's so hypocritical, and you could be turned on and off like a switch, and it was pretty pathetic. And it was another side of that part of it that made us kind of sick. And Andy especially, Andy was literally sick about it because we didn't view this, you know, the music that we made as just something fun to do. This was like our life's work, even though, you know, we took it very, you know, seriously. And Andy, I'm trying not to speak for Andy too much. Andy knows how I feel about all this, and he's got his own, I guess, feelings about it. But at the end of the day, man, we wanted people to be real. And that's why I enjoyed having Nick Nowell in the band in The Famine. He was a complete unashamed atheist, but I knew what he believed. I didn't have to guess what the dude believed. He was like,
that's blowing my mind.
Great guy.
You guys were like, finally. I don't even care if the dude's a Christian. At least I just know what he is.
Well, he's principled. He had something he believed. I think 90% of what he believed was kind of bullshit a little bit in a way, but the dude had a heart of gold, and the dude is he had a master's in English, and so lyrically, the guy was on par with some of the best lyricists I've ever listened to. I listened to some of the stuff that he wrote and read what he wrote, not, you know, 10 years later realizing what he wrote. And I'm just like, holy crap. That's really awesome.
Did he write any lyrics? Did Nick have anything to do with lyrics for the first Famine album?
I think he wrote lyrics on a song or two, because what happened is history repeated itself. We went to the studio, Chris didn't have shit, so we ended up I wrote a song, lyrics to a song, Cut from the Stone. Andy wrote another whole big bunch of lyrics for that first Famine record. Nick probably wrote some lyrics for that record, and Chris sang them all. So, and then, you know, after that, we realized what had happened again. And then we went a different direction with him. So.
Okay. That's interesting.
Wait, The Famine, the second album. That was all Nick, 100% Nick. And probably some of the best lyrical writing I'd ever heard. I was blown away with what he wrote. In his perspective, because it was introspective, it was philosophical, it was political, it was all of that on that record. That's why I loved it, man. The record had a real nervous, angry feel to it, and his lyrics just sat right on top of it beautifully. I loved it. Andy didn't care for it too much, but I absolutely, I still get chills thinking about some of the stuff that he wrote. It's so fantastic.
Wow. Okay. Wow. You just spawned like 8 questions, and I don't want to, I don't want to make, like, I don't want to make it sound like a, let's drag people over coals.
No, no, absolutely. And I don't, because I've made my peace with all these dudes. And like I said, we had, several of them.
I guess that's my first question. Are you and Chris cool?
No, not at all. Chris is, here's the funny thing about it is that we had this whole get together the other day and at my house and just to hang out and have a good time with each other. And he didn't want anything to do with it. And he was vocal about the fact he didn't want anything to do with it. And we're all kind of like, why? Man, it's kind of weird. You know, we've been having Kevin, our old bass player come out and he would, you know, we all had beef with Kevin and I just figured we're all 40 damn years old. I mean, we're all grown ass men. Let's all have a good time about it and high five and listen to some of the music and all that. And we did that and found out that Chris didn't want to be a part of it because I was going to be there. Well, it's at my damn house. I mean, of course I'm going to be there, you know, but
I would think so.
Yeah. It just didn't make any sense, man. And I have extremely little sympathy for the guy on a lot of levels because, like I said, I understood Nick. I understood the decisions that Nick made with his life. I understood his direction, his heart, and his intent. And mm-hmm. with a guy like Chris, I just felt like, you know, he doesn't know if he's coming or going. I know he's got some issues of, you know, I don't know what they are mentally. I have no idea. I just know that when you cannot get over yourself enough to understand that you've got brothers that you created music with and the past is the past and we're all just trying to, sit back and talk about it, the accomplishments, the good times, the bad times, and, you know, and just laugh about it. And he's still, I guess, stuck back in all that mess 20 years ago or whatever, or 10 years ago as well. But, I don't know, man. I guess it's not necessarily beef. I just think he's, you know, kind of a weaker minded person and he wants apologies and he wants to be, propped up and talked about as, you know, for whatever. I've never really been into that. I guess I wanted the music to stand for itself. I want, mm-hmm. my words to stand for themselves and be that kind of person. I don't need anybody to apologize to me or to pat me on the back or anything else. I just want to tell it like it is. So,
okay. I appreciate that. I mean, I'm not digging dirt or anything. This is surprising to me.
I'm a grown ass man, so I'll just say how I feel. So,
you said, let's go back to Nick for a second. You said you think 90% of what he believes in is bullshit.
You're right.
is that a specific? Hold on. Whoa. Is that a specific Nick thing or is that an atheism thing?
Oh, no. I think that's just Nick. One of the biggest, okay. One of the biggest jokers and dumbasses on the face of the planet. But he's probably one of the funniest, silliest guys and has the biggest balls of anybody I've ever known. And I mean, like, literal, like, balls, not like braveness. He's got huge, huge balls.
Well, I'm upper class, high society. God's gift to ballroom notoriety. And I always fill my ballroom. The event is never small. The social pages say I've got the biggest balls of all. I've got big balls. I've got big balls. They're such big balls. And they're tiny big balls. And he's got big balls.
Well, now I need proof. Now I got to get Nick on the podcast. It's going to be, we're going to get the cameras
take
up.
Take my word on that.
Do I want to know how you know that? Did you guys have like a comparison thing?
Well, he had a really weird fetish on the road of wearing Daisy Duke pants, shorts.
Oh no!
And he would let them hang out the side. I mean, just sitting there waiting until you noticed. And they were giant. They were disproportionate to his package, and that was the comedy of it.
So clearly, you say 90% of what you think Nick believes in is bullshit, and that's obviously now you're just jealous of his balls. I get that.
Exactly.
Now. Okay. All right. Fair enough. Hey, man. Let's be honest. let's be transparent.
No, Nick has a real progressive view, and what I find about a lot of progressive people is they also have a real populist view. Like whatever is popular right now, I'm for it. And you know, anything of faith and spirituality, that's old. That was for my parents. That's not me. I'm enlightened. Nick suffered from a lot of that, in a really weird, disrespectful way, especially to Andrew.
Mm.
And to me too. My faith is incredibly important to me too. But it really bothered Andy a lot more than it bothered me. Cause again, I was looking for authenticity, and that's what you get with Nick. He's authentic, but he's very progressive. And like I said, I don't have a lot of, I don't know. I don't have all those bad feelings about Nick at all. I'm sure he was pissed with the way I left the band for sure. And he may have some sour grapes about that, but I think nothing but the best of the guy. I had a lot of good times with that guy.
So now, I mean, I definitely want to talk embodiment and famine and everything, and even the new project you're involved with called Constant mm-hmm. Seas. But let's hold on, though. You've opened so many cans of worms, I don't know where to stick my fork first. So how much of this was going on then? Like, I guess I'm kind of like the one line that sticks through my head. And again, this is I resonate as a Christian. I am not calling this a Christian podcast. I'm not saying Chris is wrong. I'm not saying Nick is right. I'm not saying you're right. Nothing. We're just talking here. But the line that pops in my head is from an embodiment song when Chris is screaming, "Call me what you want. The truth remains the same. I am branded Christian."
Was probably written by Andy.
It's probably written by Andy and sung by a guy who wasn't even believing it. Okay, fair enough.
Right.
I'm not like boo for him or anything. But how much of that was going on back then? I'll bet you people are interested in knowing. Like,
it was
what the hell was Tooth and Nail and Solid State at that
time?
But
that's the whole thing, man. It is pervasive. I think throughout the whole group of us now. And again, I feel like there was a lot of authenticity out there with a lot of people and individuals. And individually, and I say that I think of guys in Living Sacrifice for sure. I think of, let's see, it's pathetic that I have to strain my brain to think about who's authentic, but that's kind of what it came
and
to.
And again,
that's
I'm not
what we realized. Right.
I hope this didn't come across like, "Hey, give me a list of fakes." I don't want it to be like
no.
that. I just think, I mean, I'm a little taken back by that, honestly. I thought I was kind of under the impression that Chris resonated as Christian and then at one point decided, mm-hmm. "Nope, I'm going to go another way." I didn't know he was like that the whole time or that there was any kind of back and forth. I find that interesting. And I just know that back then, Tooth and Nail and Solid State, it was the Christian label. And I remember in the documentary, he said, we at least tried to make sure that the vocalist was Christian and writing Christian lyrics.
Well,
you guys never had one.
So, okay, where do I start with all that? I think, because yeah, you touched on not necessarily raw nerve, but the raw truth of the matter. And I think let me start off positively and say that I feel like everything kind of came back around. Everybody is not wearing their church clothes anymore and having their Sunday attitudes and everybody's just real, because life has happened to all of us. Life has happened. All of us have gone through divorces. All of us have, you know, lost people we've loved. A lot of us have struggled financially or struggled in all these different ways. So real life kind of, you know, washed us clean of all that. And now you've gotten a lot of realness from a lot of us. Now, it may sound like cynicism to some people, but I don't have anything to be cynical about. It's just, it's honesty with me. What happened with those bands and those labels back in the day isn't anything that anybody didn't really realize. I mean, anybody who went to Cornerstone saw that, you know, everybody was getting blowjobs in their tents and smoking cigarettes afterwards, this, that, and the other. As long as you got on stage and did your thing, you were good to go. And then you left with your fistful of money. And it was, you know, we weren't all having Bible studies. That's my point. You know, we weren't like racing to the next city to have a Bible study with the next band. That way we can, you know, go do some outreach and some missionary work. It didn't work that way. And it's a sad part of it, that none of us could really be honest with each other. But there were some incredibly real moments on the road that I recall that were very individual spiritual moments where we did individually, not necessarily as a band collectively on stage or anything like that, but I had some really real moments with people, people that were struggling, people that really, you know, were at a crossroads in their faith or whatnot. And I think those were the times where I felt like I wasn't a hypocrite in that aspect. Because, man, I hated rolling up playing in a church. It bothered me to my core.
Why?
It did the other guys, too. Well, a lot of it was because I knew our hearts. I knew that the band that we were trying to be, music was a centerpiece, and that's what we wanted. It was about music, and we would be browbeaten, you know, by certain people that were just like, you don't say Jesus enough. You guys are too obscure. You guys look kind of rough. Your album artwork doesn't look Christian, or just you name it. And it became a real cheapening of what we started out as, and what I say we started out as. A lot of us, I've maintained my faith over all these years. So has Andrew, steadfastly. Like I said, we're just a lot more real now, because we've lived a lot of life in the past 20 years. But from that point to now, you know, you really start looking inward at your intentions and why we're doing it. And, you know, we went through a phase of where people would just, you know, looking at us almost as a missionary, or like what we're doing as a ministry. We're like, hell no, we're a band. What missionary? What? We're a band. That's what we're trying to do, is play music. And so we get pulled into churches and stuff like that. And that was the weird thing, man. I guess trying to square away the aggression and what we were trying to do, and then, you know, play it in a church. I guess I just felt weird about it. I don't know if it was the Baptist in me or whatever. But yeah, and then couple that with a label that was just so blatantly, you know, outwardly Christian, but thought it was cool and hip and trendy to kind of walk the line I guess try to see where that line was and touch it and do that. And it put us all, I think, in a really weird place where you were a Christian in the band. And then once you got kicked out of the band, you instantly, like, you got kicked out of, like, Christianity. Like, but let me put it this way. Your faith was important to you as a means to an end to keep, like, an image of the band a certain way. And then once you get in the van, you know, you're like, fuck that. Anybody got any, you know, alcohol? What do we got? You know, playing cards, let's do this. Oh, and then you pull up to the next place, to the next church, and you're like, oh, yeah, what kind of youth group do you have? And, you know, it's just, it was really, really bizarre. None of us had bad intentions, and I don't even put embodiment or the famine in any of those categories, because we were very intentional about what we were doing and what we were saying. And like I said, regardless of what Chris or Nick or any of them felt about lyrics that Andy wrote on the spiritual side, he believed them. We believe them. And still to this day, you know, faith in Jesus and all that is something that's massively important to me and my family. Mm-hmm. And it's something that still guides me today. But I do know that I don't have to mix it with music to feel a certain way or anything else. I'll still pop in a Pantera record and I love it. And I don't need to immediately pop in, you know, Stephen Curtis Chapman to kind of wash it down. It's just not true. You know, it's a whole different ball game. And I think it just comes from honesty and not commingling the two, which I think is where Solid stayed and Tooth and Nail and all that. I mean, they were directly responsible for mingling this image and this music with Christianity and almost cheapened it. So
interesting.
It's really, really, yeah, really hard. Then you start thinking about, you know, the fact that I never had our label call us up and ask how our spiritual life was, asked how my family was, or asked, you know, is there anything we can pray for you about? It was nothing about that. So it was a hard part of trying to reconcile what it meant to be a Christian band on a Christian label, you know, and it just didn't square very well with a lot of us. And it started getting to the point where it really didn't matter. Like I said, it was kind of weird. Went to a weird point.
Wow. Yeah. Every time you say something, I don't know what direction to run in.
Nah, I'm leaving it open to you. I'll go any direction you want.
It's like a huge topic. I so many of these podcasts have been like, where'd you buy your first drum set? And then tell me about the band. Tell me this and that. This is good. I just
this is way, way farther than that, man. I mean, to be honest with you, and what I wanted you to understand too, and everybody that would be listening to this to understand, this is not sour grapes. I've got nothing to have sour grapes about. I live in the nicest house in the nicest neighborhood in my part of Fort Worth and run a business, and I'm successful, and I'm still in music. I still hang out with a lot of the guys that I played with, and this is not sour grapes at all. It's just the raw honesty of what I feel a lot of people should understand, kind of what happened and what the fallout of a lot of that has been. When you have people that attach their faith to a band, you know, and I understand it can really help a lot of people through a lot of dark times, and I get it, but it can be incredibly destructive to the people in those bands when that's their identity, is their faith is attached to a band. And you saw that a lot with Solid State. You saw that a lot with a lot of the people that we rolled with back in the day. I don't know, man. I just felt like it should have been more authentic, and I don't feel like it was. And that's just from my point of view. I've been in these shows, and I've seen, and I keep bringing up Living Sacrifice. I've seen their shows, and I've seen what a lot of that stuff has done to people in their lives. And it's fantastic, and it's amazing to me, and it is 100% authentic. But there's the whole other side of it that it's just not seen. I don't know if it's meant to see. I mean, you look at everybody, you know, everybody in their real life, and you know, you see the outside of their home and the car they drive, but you don't see their, you know, the skeletons in their closet and all that stuff like that. I guess that was the whole thing, is that, you know, our shit did stink. We did have a lot of skeletons in the closet, and the problem with that is that, on a philosophical level, when you're 20 years older and you start thinking about a lot of that, you got to square it away in your head, and sometimes it doesn't square away so easily.
Right.
And, you know, that's kind of where we get to where we are now. And, you know, a lot of what I say will sound like cynicism, but it's not. It's just, like I said, it's honesty. It unfortunately, or fortunately, actually, it also brought about a lot of really awesome music.
Yeah.
That I'm really proud about. So I also have to say, before I forget, too, Sean Corbray, who wrote the last three Embodiment records, was also just unbelievably phenomenal as a lyricist. He was an okay singer, but a phenomenal lyricist. I heaped a lot of praise on Nick, and I forgot to do that for Sean. Sean is still to this day. He's phenomenal.
Whatever happened to him?
I don't know. I don't know. When Embodiment broke up, 2003 or 4-ish or whatever, he faded off into the sunset and didn't do anything musically, from what I know. Turned the page, and that was that for him. So more power to him. More power to him, because I think that's a real noble thing when you can have that sort of finality and direction, and that's what he did.
When you guys switched directions so much melodically, and then you made the move from Chris to Sean, did the new Embodiment 2.0, did you guys play Embrace songs?
That came up actually
live. And then did Sean pull them off? And if you didn't play them, did you have fans with just doing the whole like, boo, we want the old stuff kind of thing?
They were pissed. They were pissed for a long time. And I understood it. I totally understood it. But there are a lot of mistakes that we made and that I made back in the day as far as you know, trying to figure out what we wanted to do. And it's hard to think. You got an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid, you know, making these decisions that people still talk about 20 years later. I mean, it's ridiculous. But that's what we were doing as, you know, Andy was 16, 17, I think it was 18 or 19 and about to record the next record, or we're writing for the next record. And, you know, we had nothing guiding us other than just our whims about music and wanting to write something awesome. It wasn't anything, you know, intentional other than the fact that we were just wanting to write the best music we could. And again, like I said, it's funny that it's still brought up today. And we had a big discussion about it, too, at the band meeting time that we had. It was a lot of fun, but... I can't look back on any of it as anything. It's hard to explain. We were just kind of stream of consciousness as a band, and you can tell that throughout the music that we made. It kind of just went where it wanted to go, and that's how it ended. Mm-hmm.
Did you guys play? Did you do Embrace songs with Sean?
So about that. We did try a couple times to intermingle some Embrace stuff with the latter stuff, the new stuff, but it was such a departure. If we tried it, it wasn't very long, and then we realized we couldn't do it because we had this buffer between Embrace Eternal and Aeroscope of Things. We recorded a couple songs with Barry, Halo of Winter, which... was a
yes,
Halo of Winter was fantastic.
Why do I do it all alone?
Chris and I, hey, Chris wrote the lyrics to that, believe it or not. So, okay. Chris did that, and I loved it. We loved the vocal delivery. We loved everything about it. And so we actually played Halo of Winter almost nightly as a segue between old embodiment and new embodiment. And that went over really, really well. But that was really about all we could really do. I was trying to think if we did do any Embrace, but that's right. I think mainly we just did Halo of Winter.
I regret my wishes, my wish dying.
Intermingled it with the heavier parts of the new stuff that we had written at the time for Narrow Scope of Things, and it worked well, but it wasn't extreme death metal. It wasn't anything that's going to keep the real metal kids happy. They were pissed for sure. So,
really?
And I think that's what led to the famine, to be honest with you. We felt like we did everything we could with Latter-day Embodiment, with the records we put out, especially the last one that we did. Didn't have anything to do with Tooth and Nail. We actually did a demo deal with Universal and did some stuff when we recorded an album on our own, and that I think sealed the deal on everything that we want to do with Embodiment. And then Embodiment broke up, and then talking with Andy a couple of years later, the one thing that we did have a regret about is finding out how much further we could have taken that early Embodiment sound, and that's what brought us to the famine.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense. Did the label? I mean, you guys moved record companies labels a couple times during the Embodiment 2.0 stuff. Was that because of the style, or was it just time to go? Band switch labels, no big deal.
I think. Well, let me go back to this. Once we recorded our first album, first thing we did was Solid State, and we're getting letters and emails and MySpace, it was MySpace and stuff like that. Messages from kids all across the country that had our album, this, that, and the other. And I was just like, okay, wow, this is awesome. This is great. And then, you know, let's wait for this first quarter to wrap up and I'll call the label and see how well we did, see what kind of money we're going to get. And I was a naive, naive young kid, and I called the label and I basically got laughed at, you know, and was just like, y'all aren't going to make any money, and y'all make money on the road. Are you kidding me? And once I realized that I was stupid for asking if we made any money from the label, that's where some sour grapes came in for sure. Then I realized, oh, they're not working with us. And I realized, you know, I guess the hard part of the music industry, which is you don't have any rights to your music. You have rights to what you play live. That's basically it. And so
are you talking about Embrace, like early stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we recouped on Embrace about 10 years later, and I probably still owe Tooth and Nail $60,000-$70,000. You know, via the band, they'll never get it. They'll just own our stuff forever. But we never recouped. I think we recouped off Embrace the Eternal, and that was it. And I remember very specifically. I hate to call him out, but Bill Power was, I think, our A&R at the time, I believe. And I called him up, and I was like, "So I'm seeing that we've sold all these records, and are you telling me that, you know, we still owe you guys like $11,000?" And it seemed like he was locked and loaded, if I remember correctly, and just berated me. And was just like, you're crazy. You don't understand what we do. You don't understand, you know, what it takes for us to do what we do. And you should just be lucky that we helped put the album out. And your job is to go out and play it. And if you play it, then you'll make money. And then, you know, it was bad. And I learned my lesson real quickly of, you know, where I stood. In relation to, because I handle a lot of the band's management type deals, and I just learned real quickly is my point. And that ever since then, I just shut up. We recorded and we got through it as fast as we could, because we realized we're not going to make money under that contract period ever. End of story. That's why we started looking at Universal and looking at that other stuff, and realizing that there were bands that were surviving and doing well. And, you know, we shot for the moon and didn't quite make it, but we made some really good music along the way, and were able to, all of us, not go broke in the process, so, but with no help from the label, so.
If that's the case, and you live off money on the road, were you guys doing all right on the road, or did switching styles and vocalists like totally shoot out your own tires?
That's not what shot out our own tires. What shot out our own tires is trying to be legitimate, trying to go out and play a real club on 6th Street in Austin instead of at the local church in Austin. But this is here's the key to understanding that mindset of what we were dealing with is we play Joe Blow, First United Methodist Church, and we can get a $1,500 guarantee, or we play a real club in Austin and get $75. And we were so hungry at the time for legitimacy, for like real metalheads to hear what we were doing, and we would realize we were going to go baroque. And I'm not talking like, you know, we wouldn't have money to, you know, pay our Lexus or whatever. No, it was, we're all going to have to stay living with our parents. And we'd stay living with our parents till, you know, for the rest of the time, because we wanted to be legitimate. And it was the bitter pill to swallow, which led to a lot of the hypocrisy of booking shows at churches and realizing you can roll into a church and get a $1,000 guarantee. And you can get fed and you can get probably set up for the night. And
sure.
And I guess it's the path that you chose. And we chose a lot of the times to get the more legitimate shows, as hardcore as we tried to be with that, and there enters, you know, Cornerstone and why we partook in that for so long.
Wow. Again, here we go with so many worms. What kind of contract did you sign with Embodiment? Like, was it like a three album? Like, you made it sound like
it was. It was 3 + 1, so it was 4 albums total.
What does that mean?
And like I said,
why is three plus one not called 4?
Because it's a 3 with one option. 3 albums guaranteed we had to do. And if you know, we sucked and it wasn't going to work out, it was their option to do a 4th album with us.
They get the option. Okay. All right.
They
all
do.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay. And so Embrace and Narrow Scope of Things and Hold Your Breath were contractually signed.
Right.
When you were all what, 16?
Not even old enough to legally sign a damn contract.
Huh.
I'll leave that right there.
There you have it. This is the first half of the Mark Garza Chronicles. I just didn't expect him to be so blatant and forthright about everything, so I just decided to go with it. How awesome is this? If anyone got offended at anything that Mark said, whatever, dude. Talk to Mark. I just recorded him. The song that you're hearing right now is Mark's solo project called Loist. I think I'm saying it right. L-H-O-I-S-T, L, Hoist. He's covering Radiohead's Lurgy. And Mark does all this music that you're hearing. He does everything by himself. Next week, we're going to cover his current project, Constant Seas. Mark is also recording a group called SKG with his wife. And he throws more gut punches at the industry. It's going to be fun to listen to. Thanks for all who make this possible through Patreon. If you're interested in helping out, you can click the links to Patreon and check into that. There's some extra stuff on there for the people who help out. Oh, now my dog's barking. Thanks for listening. Love you.